Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt at 1400 hours GMT on Thursday, the 25th of January, and these are our main stories. Reports from Russia say missile fragments and two black box flight recorders have been found at the site of a plane crash, which is said to have killed tens of Ukrainian prisoners of war. Intense fighting between Israeli forces and Hamas militants has continued in southern Gaza after a United Nations shelter for displaced people was hit. Also coming up in this podcast.
These all came from the British raid on Kumasi in 1874. This is a peace pipe when Ashanti kings got together.
Ashanti gold. The UK is to loan back Ghana's looted crown jewels. But we begin this Global News podcast with the ongoing blame game between Russia and Ukraine, more than 24 hours after a Russian military plane came down near the Ukrainian border, killing all 74 people on board. Russia, which says the plane was carrying Ukrainian prisoners of war, said Ukraine had shot it down and called for an inquiry into President Volodymyr Zelensky. Mr. Zelensky, though, for his part, said there should be an international investigation.
It is obvious that the Russians are playing with the lives of Ukrainian prisoners, with the feelings of their relatives, and with the emotions of our society. We need to establish all the clear facts as much as possible, given that the downing of the plane occurred on Russian territory, which is beyond our control.
Well, Ukraine has not admitted to shooting down the plane, but did say that Russian aircraft flying in that area were considered legitimate targets. Russia now says it's recovered two black boxes from the crash site, which should contain crucial voice and data recordings. But whether any Russian report on them is believed, or even believable, is open to question. In a moment, we'll hear from our correspondents in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. But first, I spoke to Elizaveta Focht from BBC Russian.
At this point, we don't have any independent confirmation of what happened. And the only things we are 100% sure about are two. The first is that the plane definitely crashed near the Ukrainian border yesterday morning. And the second is Ukraine and Russia were expected to have a massive prisoner swap yesterday. No one's denying this. Then Russia, of course, was very quick to blame Ukraine for shooting down this plane. And the Russian MOD insists it was full of Ukrainian prisoners of war and that all of them are dead now. We can't independently confirm it's true. But yesterday, Margarita Simonyan, editor-in-chief of Russia Today, one of Russia's top propagandists, published a list of the soldiers who were allegedly the passengers of this plane. And again, we don't know if it's true, but we checked more than 20 of those names and confirmed that they actually belong to people who have been mentioned, you know, in the recent months as Ukrainian prisoners of war. But again, we don't know if that were on board.
Russia says they've found two black boxes, which could be a crucial part of any investigation. What do you think the chances are that they will go further and allow, you know, maybe any Ukrainian or even international investigation into what happened? I mean, is there a chance of that?
I think the chances are really, really slim. But again, I think the main question now is not how the plane crashed. Of course, it's very important, but who was on board? And we still don't know anything about that. But again, I think the chances that Russia will allow Ukrainian or even international investigators to come at this crash site to tackle all the evidence available, so I think those chances are really, really, really slim, close to non-existent.
Elizaveta Focht. So what about the view from Ukraine's capital, Kyiv? Well, Sarah Rainsford is there.
There are huge questions to answer, and the problem of getting those answers is, of course, that the crash site is in the Belgorod region, and that at the moment there is no access to it for independent people, for outsiders. The black boxes have been recovered. Apparently, they will, of course, be examined by Russia, not by an independent body, but, of course, a state-controlled one. And the same goes for the crash site. You know, we certainly have seen fragments of that downed plane. We know that a plane came down. Ukraine hasn't denied that it may have shot that plane down. I think what's the big question is how that happened and whether or not there were, as Russia still claims, Ukrainian prisoners of war on board that plane. I mean, that's the critical question as far as Ukraine's concerned, because the chance that it might have made some kind of horrible mistake or that something so awful has happened. It will be a huge deal, of course, here within Ukraine itself. So there's a lot of questions. Of course, there's a lot of competing statements. But I think, you know, we should say one thing pretty clearly. Of course, this is a war. Of course, there is misinformation and propaganda all around. But there is also one clear fact, which is that Russia has many, many years of proven record of lies and disinformation. And remember that this war was started on a lie. The whole idea that there was a Nazi-backed regime supposedly protecting Russian speakers from genocide. So I think it is important to keep that in mind whenever we're considering statements that come out of Moscow.
Sarah Rainsford. Now, the UK is the latest state to warn the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to agree an immediate humanitarian pause in the war with Hamas to allow more aid to get into Gaza. The latest urging came from Britain's Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, during his ongoing tour of the Middle East.
It's time for an immediate pause in the fighting, because we've got to not only get the aid in, but crucially, we've got to get those hostages out. And what I think we can do now is plan for how you turn that pause into a permanent, sustainable ceasefire without a return to fighting. That's what I was pushing on him, and that's what I'll be talking about here today.
David Cameron. Now, intense fighting between Israeli forces and Hamas militants has continued in the south of Gaza as investigations go on into whose shell fire hit a United Nations shelter for displaced people, killing several people and injuring many, many more. Our correspondent Yolande Nell in Jerusalem gave us this update.
We've got a senior UN official in Gaza talking about how there are persistent attacks on civilian sites in Khan Yunis now, saying that these are utterly unacceptable. They must stop immediately because people are being killed and injured. We're seeing very intense fighting now around the main hospitals where you have doctors and patients, but also huge numbers of displaced people. People are trapped inside. We understand that local residents saying that really there's now non-stop aerial and ground fire with the city totally encircled by Israeli ground troops.
And the UN facility that was struck by shelling, it's not clear, you know, what side essentially that came from. But do we know any more specifics about that and the number of people that were injured or who are dead?
What we've been told is at least 9 people were killed and 75 were injured in this strike on a workshop inside the Khan Yunis training centre. It belongs to UNRWA, the biggest UN agency operating in the Gaza Strip, and it had been functioning as a shelter, this one building, for roughly 800 displaced Palestinians. It was set on fire by the strike, but this whole complex is where there's an estimated 30,000 displaced Palestinians. The White House was quick to come out condemning this strike. It doesn't normally issue statements about individual strikes in Gaza, but it caused a lot of concern. The Israeli military launched an investigation, it said, into the incident, but it said it already determined its air and artillery forces weren't responsible, that it was looking into its ground forces operations and also checking to see if Hamas was responsible. Because, of course, while tank shells were initially blamed by the UN for this attack, later on they changed that to shells. If it was Hamas, they could have been firing mortar shells in the area. It's still not clear.
And David Cameron, Britain's foreign secretary, is in the region having a series of meetings. And it seems the UK is the latest ally to add pressure publicly on Israel and its prime minister to bring about what they call, I think, an immediate humanitarian pause and also get more aid in more quickly to Gaza.
Yeah, you detect a bit of a shift in British policy here. The Foreign Secretary's been talking about the need for a humanitarian pause to stop the intense fighting. What's new is he's also talking about how this should lead into a longer-term ceasefire. So basically, this should be the beginning of a stop to the war. Interesting that that is something that reports have said Qatar and Egypt, as mediators, have been suggesting to delegations from Israel and Hamas as they've been overseeing these indirect talks. And they've laid out a plan, we're told, for a new deal bringing a ceasefire and the release of the remaining 100 plus Israeli hostages held in Gaza.
Yolande Nell speaking to us from Jerusalem. Now, the Austrian man who was jailed for life after imprisoning and raping his own daughter could be transferred from a psychiatric hospital to a normal prison. Lawyers for Josef Fritzl, who fathered 7 children by his daughter, say it could pave the way for him to apply eventually for release to a nursing home. From Vienna, here's Bethany Bell.
Josef Fritzl is now 88 years old and has dementia. The court ruling follows a new psychiatric report which said that he no longer poses a danger. The judges said he could be moved into a regular prison, but they ruled out his release and transfer to a care home. The decision by the court in the town of Krems an der Donau is subject to appeal. For the moment, Josef Fritzl, who's changed his name, will remain in the secure psychiatric unit pending the appeal.
We're going to look now at the crimes of two men in different parts of the world, both of which have resulted in the most serious of sentences, their execution. One started a fire that killed dozens of people at a film studio in Kyoto. Another shot a woman in a gun-for-hire killing in Alabama. Both of these cases have stoked debate about capital punishment, but for different reasons. First then to Japan, where a court has sentenced Shinji Aoba to death for an arson attack on an animation studio in 2019 that left 36 people dead. Most of them were trapped in the building that he had set fire to. It was one of Japan's worst ever murder cases. Our correspondent there is Shima Khalil.
Shinji Aoba had burst into the studio in July 2019 during a work day. He splashed petrol on the ground floor of that building, setting it alight. And that meant that the fire then trapped people on the top floor, 36 of whom had died. And all the while, as he was doing that, he was saying, "Drop dead, drop dead." He said, when he was speaking to the court years later, he said, "I felt I had no other option but to do what I did at the time." But of course, this then led to one of Japan's worst ever, not only arson attacks, but mass murder attacks, something that still shocks the nation every time that story is relived, every time it comes up with another development in the court. You feel this outpouring, especially from anime fans on social media, on X, formerly known as Twitter. Because remember, most of the 36 people who died were anime artists, animators, who are held in such high regard here. And this particular studio, this building, is a beloved one nationwide.
Can you just give us a little insight into that, I suppose, cult, for want of a better word, of anime in Japan and how significant it is to Japanese society?
This is something that is synonymous to Japan. This is a huge industry right now, whether it's the anime comic books or anime cartoons or videos. It has a huge following here in Japan and all over the world. And the tragedy has not only shocked people in its nature and the way that it had happened and the way that it was executed, but also what it hit. It hit the heart of culture here, if you will. And that's why, for example, today, looking at X, formerly known as Twitter, you see people, for example, reacting to the verdict saying, "Look, I'm sorry about the death sentence that he's gotten, given how troubled he is as a person. But this was the right one. Those people, those animators who died," someone said on X, "were gods to me."
Well, from the case of Shinji Aoba, let's look now at the case of Kenneth Smith, a man who has already survived one attempt to execute him by the authorities in the southern U.S. state of Alabama. He's due to be put to death at some point on Thursday for murdering a woman in the 1980s. But it's the way that the state intends to kill him that has proved so contentious. After trying but failing to execute him already by lethal injection 2 years ago, the state government now wants to use nitrogen gas to end his life. That would be a first in the U.S. Our correspondent Tom Bateman sent this report.
Kenneth Eugene Smith has spent three decades on death row. He's already dodged death once. His executioners botched an attempt to kill him by lethal injection, and now he faces suffocation by the state. Opponents see this as a crucial test case and are urging Alabama's governor to stop it, led by Smith's spiritual advisor, who will be in the execution chamber with him.
"So I need some assurance that this is safe. So this right here is an invitation to Governor Ivey to accompany me into the execution chamber."
It was 2 weeks ago today, 45-year-old...
Smith was convicted in 1989 for his part in the murder of Elizabeth Sennett, the wife of a preacher who paid Smith $1,000. The jury said he should get life in jail, but the judge sentenced him to death. One medical expert against capital punishment explains that inhaling pure nitrogen will starve the body of oxygen but could cause catastrophic mishaps.
It's very likely if he doesn't die, he could be significantly injured by this experience. And for that matter, so could other people in the proximity of Kenneth Smith, because the nitrogen gas, some of it will be exhaled along with carbon dioxide. Some of it may leak out of the mask.
The victim's family backs the death penalty. Alabama's governor's office claims the method has been thoroughly vetted, saying it is ready to move forward, although the authorities haven't presented any plausible evidence of its safety. So far, urgent calls for a stay of execution, including from the UN, have not been heeded. And Smith awaits death for a second time. Many US states have been moving away from carrying out executions. Alabama remains an outlier, and today's case is supercharging America's debate over state-sanctioned death.
Tom Bateman in the US. Now, I'm going to apologise in advance for this, but still to come on the Global News podcast. Why this sound? Oh, it's white noise. Why is it good for mushrooms? Well, it's unbearable for us, but apparently it helps them grow. Welcome back to the Global News podcast. Now, which football club generates the most money? It's been Manchester City for a while, but now the Abu Dhabi-owned English Premier League champions have been overtaken by Real Madrid. The Spanish club, which is owned by its fans, is the wealthiest, according to the annual Football Money League produced by the consulting firm Deloitte. Real's revenue was $921 million last season. Manchester City's was a little less, about $7 million less. Tim Bridge is from Deloitte.
We've got Real Madrid at the top for the first time in a couple of years. Of course, everybody knows Real Madrid, one of the biggest brands globally in football. They've had record retail sales this year that have kind of propelled them above Manchester City, who had the best season that you could probably possibly have on pitch. Manchester City slightly limited by size of their stadium and the match day revenue that they generate. And then up into third place, Paris Saint-Germain, who benefited from investment actually into the club through the French league from the private equity house CVC, which is a trend that we're seeing across sport, that external investment. More broadly, there's eight Premier League clubs that are in the top 20 this year, and that actually might be a little bit of a surprise to people, because for a number of years we've talked about the dominance of the Premier League, the rest of Europe really fighting back in terms of its ability to compete financially. As we will always say, there is real evidence of polarisation financially within football. The need to think about better distribution, or the best way to distribute the financial wealth across the game, remains really front of mind. And our data just shows that that's necessary.
Also, some interesting notes in your numbers about growth in the women's game commercial-wise as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's such an interesting finding this year. We've looked at the top 15 clubs across European football in the women's game, and the growth is really significant. And the women's game, I think we shouldn't be shy in really thinking about how, yes, we hope that broadcast revenue grows, but fundamentally it may be a slightly different business model that underpins the growth of the women's game in the future. And that commercial revenue line, bringing forward the athlete, telling the story of those females that are playing at the top of elite sport, could be the real driver that kicks the women's game on.
That was Tim Bridge speaking to Will Bain. Well, as you heard the two of them discussing, women's football is part of the growth in revenue for Real Madrid. And remember, Spain's women are the world champions, but their victory last year was overshadowed by the moment that the man in charge of Spanish football forcibly kissed a player. It led to the end of the career of Luis Rubiales as a football administrator. And now a judge has ruled that he should face a criminal trial for sexual assault. The judge also said that he and three other officials should face coercion charges after the televised moment when Jenny Hermoso was kissed, she says, against her will. So has the judge's decision come as a surprise? Well, here's our reporter in Spain, Guy Hitchcock.
I don't think it's unexpected, given all the attention that Luis Rubiales has received and the fact that this was such a public kiss and there was so much criticism of him at the time, and that we saw prosecutors sort of pursue this investigation almost immediately after it happened. Now, the charges Mr. Rubiales would face in this trial are for sexual assault for that kiss that he gave Jenny Hermoso straight after the final, and also charges of coercion, because the allegation is that he tried to persuade Jenny Hermoso to play down the importance of the kiss and to come out publicly and say that it had been consensual after it happened. And those allegations of coercion are also levelled at these three members of the Federation, or former members of the Federation in some cases, who are seen as allies of Mr. Rubiales, and they include the former women's national coach, Jorge Vilda, who was the coach of the national team when they won the World Cup.
And those others were accused of, not really a cover-up, but essentially acting in a conspiracy, allegedly, to get her to say things that she will say just weren't true.
Yes, that's right. I mean, in the immediate aftermath of the World Cup final, this kiss really overshadowed the celebrations that followed it. And the controversy became so huge so quickly that Mr. Rubiales appears to have realised that this was going to be very bad for his image. And the allegation is, and he does deny this, that he tried to get these members of the Federation and the national coach to help him try and exert pressure on Jenny Hermoso, either directly or through her family, in one case through her brother, to try and persuade them that it was in her interest to come out and say, oh, this was no problem, this was all consensual, I wasn't bothered by this at all. So those three, Jorge Vilda and also Albert Luque and Ruben Rivera, will go on trial as well for those coercion charges.
Now, 150 years after they were looted from Ghana by British soldiers, items holding huge cultural and religious importance are heading back to the country for the first time. In a landmark agreement, the British Museum and the Victoria and Albert Museum, both of them here in London, are returning them on loan to Ghana. Our cultural editor, Katie Razzle, has more.
These all came from the British raid on Kumasi in 1874.
Kumasi, in the south of modern-day Ghana, was the capital of the Ashanti Empire, which was in repeated conflict with the British in the 19th century.
This is a peace pipe. When Ashanti kings got together to make peace...
Angus Patterson is senior curator of metalwork at the V&A. He's showing me some of the items which are being returned to Ghana.
This is made of gold, which obviously... was extremely common in the Ashanti court. You can pick that one up if you wish.
That is heavy.
Casting.
What I'm holding is a pendant of cast gold, decorated with concentric bands and coming to a point in the middle. British soldiers looted the regalia in 1874 from the palace of the Ashanti king, the Asantehene, in Kumasi.
This, which is the beaten gold, which is incredibly fragile.
Also with me is the director of the V&A, Tristram Hunt.
You can see the tear, and that's because of the kind of violence with which it was ripped out of the ornaments by the British troops. So there's a symbol in itself of the way in which these items entered the collection. They're complex. Objects are complex.
The V&A has agreed to send these 17 pieces back to Ghana. They'll go on long-term loan to the Mencia Palace Museum.
They will come back to the UK and then they will go back to Ghana as well.
Is this restitution by the back door?
This isn't restitution by the back door because we're governed by an act which means that the Victoria and Albert Museum cannot deaccession, it's called. It cannot restitute its collections.
Looted Ashanti gold is as precious to Ghana as the Benin bronzes are to Nigeria. The agreement isn't with the Ghanaian government, but instead with Otumfo Osei Tutu II, the current Asantehene. The Ashanti built a formidable empire steeped in gold. The deal's chief negotiator is Ivor Ajimandia.
There's so much interest in these items.
Is there still in Ghana huge anger about the raid in 1874?
There is anger. Anytime it comes up, people look at it in colonial terms. Looting of items, precious items belonging to people, are things that they don't easily forget.
Is the fact that you're taking them on loan a problem?
It's not really a problem. At least these objects will be home after 150 years.
For a lot of people, it's going to be incredibly problematic.
Nana Afuriata Aim is an advisor to Ghana on reparation and restitution. She says, politically, the Ghanaian government couldn't have made a loan deal like this.
No, I think it would have just sent out a terrible message in a way. I mean, the metaphor is someone comes into your home and steals something from your house, keeps it in their house, and then, you know, X amount of years later comes and says, I'm going to lend you your thing back. It's nonsensical.
So this is a way to get the items back on display without having to involve the government, because the deal could be done with the Asantehene.
Yeah, yeah. And also, obviously, the law can be changed. I mean, we saw it with the Holocaust items. There is a precedence for the law being changed.
As well as the V&A, the British Museum is loaning 15 items, including a cast gold Ashanti sword of state. The returning Ashanti gold pieces, which haven't been seen in Ghana since they were looted, will go on display there in April.
Katie Razzle with beautiful things that you can see and you can feel as well. But what about those that you can hear? Well, nature is just full of wonderful noises, isn't it? But what about this? OK, I think that's enough of that. Well, not exactly. That sound, white noise, has been found to help fungi grow faster. Even though we struggle with it, it could also help lead to ways to speed up composting and restoring habitat. Now, the man behind the research is Jake Robinson of Flinders University in Adelaide in Australia, and he's been speaking to my colleague Nick Robinson.
There's some evidence to suggest that sound waves could stimulate the growth of microorganisms. So we wanted to know if we could apply sound waves to then change the decomposition rate in soil.
And it worked.
And it worked. We found that it actually increased the biomass, it increased the fungal biomass in teabags, the humble teabag, which is an understated tool in scientific experiments. You plant the teabags in some soil and then blast some sounds at them and then see if it has an effect on the fungal growth. That was the first part of the study. And the second part of the study, after we found these results, we wanted to know if we could culture certain fungi that were known to be beneficial for plants and then see if the same effect happened again. And it did. The actual sounds increased the growth of fungi in petri dishes.
Are you simply replicating what's happening in the natural world? Because we talked on the programme a while back about the extraordinary soundscape of natural soil that the earthworms, the ants and all the rest do produce sound. Is that what you're doing, or are you going a stage further?
From one perspective, we're trying to see if we can experiment with different sound parameters to then see if we can speed up the restoration process in soil. So something like 75% of soils across the world are currently degraded. So we're trying to repair them by stimulating them with sounds. From another perspective, you know, there's a global rise in noise pollution as well. So we want to see if there are any negative effects on the soil from these harmful sounds potentially as well.
Quite tricky to scale up, Jake, though, if you conclude it works, isn't it? I mean, it's all very well playing a bit of white noise into a Petri dish. But how on earth would you do it across a field or a landscape?
Yeah, so that's one of the main, that'd be one of the main challenges next. If we wanted to try and stimulate soil, would be how we would be able to scale it up. So it might be that we put tiny little sensors in the soil next to plants to stimulate the symbiosis between the plants and the fungi.
Jake Robinson talking to Nick Robinson, not related, by the way. Now, just before we go, I want you to think back to our early hunter-gatherer ancestors who you may think survived mostly on a diet of meat. Well, researchers in the High Andes Mountains in Peru have found that, in fact, we've had it backwards, in that part of the world at least. It turns out 80% of what those early humans ate was plant-based, only 20% was meat. That's according to analysis of the remains of 24 individuals from two burial sites dating back 9,000 years. Alex Ritson has been speaking to Dr. Randy Haas, an archaeologist from the University of Wyoming in the US.
We use some traditional approaches, which is just looking at the materials in the archaeological record. We looked at plant remains and animal bones from these early archaeological sites, and that gave us some insights into the dietary profiles of these individuals. But the major new method that we applied is human bone isotope chemistry, where we actually analyze the chemical composition of human bone. And basically, you are what you eat. The chemical makeup of your bone reflects the chemical makeup of the foods that you eat, at least in broad categories, plant foods versus terrestrial animal foods versus fish. It was the convergence of these three methods that allowed us to very accurately reconstruct these early human diets and determine that they were largely based on plants.
This flies in the face of what we were all told at school, though, doesn't it? Because we were
told by our teachers that our ancestors started eating lots of meat, and that was what gave them the change to become the hyper-intelligent humans that we are today.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. And in fact, I am a professor and I have told my students for a long time that early human diets were largely meat-based. There's good empirical reason to have thought that. There are theoretical reasons to have thought that. But now I'm confronted with some evidence that suggests the contrary. And there are good reasons to explain the disagreement with earlier and more recent evidence. It turns out that when we rely on the material record, there are certain kinds of preservation biases that result in us preferentially observing hunting-related artifacts, lithic stone tools, projectile points. They preserve really well. Animal bone, it preserves real well. So we've seen this really strong signature, hunting signature, but plant foods do not preserve very well. So we've had this sort of biased view of the archaeological record, at least in this part of the world.
So briefly tempt me, if I'd gone back to caveman times in the area you were looking at, what would have I been enjoying if I'd been invited for dinner?
So based on our dietary reconstructions from these populations that date from about 9,000 to 6,500 years ago, you probably would have had a large helping of tubers. Tubers are the roots of certain kinds of plants, and very likely these would have been the wild tubers that are related to potatoes. Potatoes were actually domesticated in this part of the world, but you probably also would have gotten at least some portion of vicuña meat or deer meat. Vicuña is the wild ancestor to the alpaca. Absent from this diet would have been fish. We don't find any evidence or very little evidence of fish consumption in this diet, and very little evidence of small mammal consumption or bird consumption.
And definitely no beef burgers.
No beef burgers.
Dr. Randy Haas from the University of Wyoming. Right, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we choose to cover in it, you can send us an email. As always, the address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Derek Clark. The producer was Ed Horton. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. And until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.